to New Realities with Alan Steinfeld. Each week on BBS Radio, I interview the people who are really bringing about a spiritual revolution in this country and the world, bringing us new information, sometimes about the past, sometimes about the future. Tonight's guest is someone who's written a book called The Star of the Magi. Her name is Courtney Roberts, and it's really about the mystery that heralded the coming of this era, and we're going to talk about that and what else is coming up in perhaps this upcoming year and the upcoming years to come. Courtney, are you there? Courtney? Hello? Courtney? Hello?
Hello?
Oh, there you are. Thanks.
Hello, okay. I'm here.
Okay, I didn't hear you for a second. To pick up where we left off, though, I think you made a very interesting point as far as the Star of the Magi, which was the star that supposedly announced the coming of a new age, you know, 2008 years ago, basically. And you said it was at that point that time, human history time, really divided itself between B.C. and A.D. because the Magi, and we'll get into talking about who they were, saw this as a new break in a new era. Can you talk about that, and then how did they know this was going to be such a dramatic time in the history of humanity?
Well, you know, we can only speculate. We don't have you know, exact, clearly written records, but we do have their traditions as they've come down to us. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we still divide time with the birth of Christ between B.C. and A.D. We have this sort of imaginary line drawn through the ages there. And, of course, that wasn't, you know, fully determined until several centuries later.
Right, but the Magi
by the Roman
saw
Church.
Something, right? They saw something.
Pardon
coming.
Me?
The Magi, and you should maybe talk a little bit about who the Magi actually were, they saw something coming.
Well, yes, they did. They, you know, they were very influenced by the idea of the millenniums and the idea that all of time and history was divided into these discrete 1,000-year periods. And by their astrological calculations, at least in the traditions that have come down to us, by their calculations, they were at the dawn of a whole new millennium, a whole new age. So they were naturally expecting a new great prophet or a new messiah to come and bring, you know, a whole new revelation in, which is pretty much what happened with the coming of Christ and the coming of Christianity.
How did they determine that? Was that an astrological configuration they saw?
Well, yes, it most certainly was. They had two preferred indicators for their millennialism. One was, of course, you know, the idea of the millenniums, and that's an idea that is still very much with us, is still very much a part of how we think about time and how we think about the meaning of time. Now, the other astrological indicator that they used was the cycle of Saturn and Jupiter conjunctions. And this is a long ongoing cycle. Saturn and Jupiter appear to meet up in the sky every 20 years, like clockwork, very regular basis. Mm-hmm. But as they do that, they trace out this beautiful pattern of interlacing triangles through the zodiac. And by the Magi's calculations, it took almost exactly 1,000 years for the cycle of the conjunctions to move all the way around the zodiac in this pattern of triangles, to move from the beginning of the zodiac to the very end of the zodiac. By their calculations, it took about 1,000 years. So when they saw that the conjunction cycle was about to move, you know, from the end of Pisces back into the beginning of Aries, the very beginning of the zodiac, that's what triggered in their mind that this must be the dawn of a new age, the dawn of a new millennium. Now, mind you, they were also aware of this idea of the precession of the equinoxes. They didn't really, you know, understand it, not in the way that we do.
Well,
but they were aware of
it. I don't really
understand.
I think a lot of people hear about the precession of the equinox, but they don't really understand what that means. What does it mean?
Right. Yeah. It's an astronomical phenomenon whereby, basically, to put it as simply as I can, because it can get very complicated. The fixed stars form the constellations. We think of them as the fixed stars because they form the same constellations for
right.
thousands of years. But they're not really fixed. They're actually moving. The whole thing is moving
right.
in relationship to us.
The stars are moving
us.
Away from each other and changing positions.
Yeah, they're moving in a cycle. So basically, when we say that the zodiac begins with the sign Aries, if you actually went out and looked at it, it would look like it began in the constellation Pisces because of precession.
Actually looked at the stars themselves, you're saying?
Yes,
they've
moved on. They've moved on, and they're still moving. So at the time of the birth of Christ, the beginning of the zodiac was actually very close to the beginning of the constellation of Aries, but it was just beginning to move back into the constellation Pisces. So that triggered in their minds the idea of a major shift, a major new era as well. And it was also, I think, to some extent responsible for the emphasis on the symbolism of the fish and the virgin among the early Christians,
because
those were
the
two...
Pisces. All those astrological components were already in place 2,000 years ago then, at the time of...
Definitely, and actually considerably further back than that,
uh-huh.
definitely.
And
yeah,
then,
and the Magi were really cracking astronomers. They were state-of-the-art in that department.
So you talked about millennialism. I mean, it seems like that would be sort of a recent phenomena since the birth of Jesus and the last 1,000, 2,000 years. But you implied that millennialism or 1,000-year groupings is a kind of ancient counting that predates this era.
Yes, you know, there's a lot of confusion on that point. But in fact, we have a quote source to a philosopher named Theopompus who lived in approximately 4th century B.C., and he specifically says that it's the Magi that use these millenniums, these astrological millenniums, to describe their history and their chronology. So this was an astrological idea that was very distinctly associated with the Magi and the way they thought about time and the way they thought about history. And it's only, after the birth of Christ that this idea of millenniums became, you know, very popular throughout the Roman Empire. But that's the actual source, is the Persian astrology of the Magi.
So let's get now into that. You did talk about a little bit about that in the last show, that the Magi were these crack astrologers who helped the Persians and there were mystics in that part of the world, and where was the source of their knowledge? Who were they really, and how did they gain such wisdom of the stars?
Well, I think the Magi are representative of a very common social structure throughout the ancient world, particularly in your Indo-European societies, where these were class-structured caste societies, and along with having a military class and a lower working class or whatever, they would always have a priestly class, like the Druids among the Celts or like the Brahmins in India. The Magi were the hereditary priestly caste of the Medes and the Persians.
Uh-huh.
And they fulfilled the traditional functions of that caste, and that would be the guardianship of religion, of its rites and rituals, but also any kind of higher education and higher knowledge. They also, their main duty was to advise the king, to use all of the knowledge they gained through these various arts to advise the king. So that was the Magi's job, so to speak. And they took this role very, very seriously, and they were renowned throughout the ancient Near East for being, you know, the greatest collectors of wisdom and the wisest of men. And you know, we have quotes, say, from Philo Judaeus in the first century that says that, you know, the Magi were known for really pushing the limits of natural science and astronomy and really actively pursuing and teaching whatever the latest advances were in those fields. That was their job.
Right.
That's what they'd done.
It was a science. So you really make in your book a kind of understanding of the sciences that were, and the mixing of science and astronomy and astrology were really all one, in a sense, at that time.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that it was that way until really quite recently. Even up until the age of Newton, almost anyone who practiced astronomy was also an astrologer. They didn't just measure and name the stars, that's astronomy, but they also tried to derive meaning from it and meaningful cosmologies from it. And even people like Kepler and Galileo and Tycho, they were all astrologers, professional astrologers, well-compensated astrologers. Kepler and Tycho both were the official court astrologer to the Holy Roman Emperor, which is not something you often find in your science textbooks. But they were very passionately dedicated to, you know, deriving meaning from the things they observed. This idea that of this split, you know, this big split and this animosity between, you know, faith and science or astrology and astronomy, it's quite recent. It's only in the last several hundred years and in a more European kind of mindset.
Well, even Newton was an alchemist and really looked for the reasons and researched a lot about how to turn metals into gold. So he
let's not mince words here. Newton was a complete religious fanatic.
What do you
by
mean?
By anyone's standards.
By what,
oh,
what
he
kind
was,
of religious fanatic?
Oh, he was an Arian heretic.
He was? What about his alchemical studies?
Oh, well, he was mad for alchemy. In fact, he spent probably the last 30, 40 years of his life doing mainly alchemy. And also, he was really into this biblical chronology, which was very astrological in its purposes. So, yeah, you know, the later biographers tried to completely erase this part of Newton's personality from his life, but he was an outright religious fanatic. There's no mincing words there.
Actually, I did read a recent biography of Newton. He did some very accurate predictions. He predicted the coming together of the State of Israel. I mean, he didn't say when, but he did predict that, and there were a bunch of other predictions that came true 100 or so years after the 1700s when he predicted those things. So,
well, he was really into historical chronology and chronography, so that doesn't surprise me at all. And of course, in doing alchemy, now, you know, some people have tried to claim that Newton was an astrologer, and that's not exactly true, but in doing alchemy, there's so much astrology involved in alchemy, and in when you actually perform the operations, choosing the right time when the planetary metals can commingle properly, that, you know, he had to have been doing a lot of that kind of astrological calculation as well. So, yeah, even up to Newton's time, as I said, your real scientists, the ones who were really pushing the limits, were very inspired people who didn't experience that kind of modern split that our society seems so imbued with.
Well, I think, you know, part of programs like this and others on, actually, BBS, is that we're bringing together, bridging the two back, the spirit and the science, back into in what Ken Wilber calls a trans-rational paradigm, you know, where we're going beyond the rational understanding and not discarding it, but including it into a more holistic, balanced brain, left brain, right brain approach to reality. That's really what we're...
And I think that's more, you know, accurate, at least historically, in terms of the history of science, because, as I said, most of these great inventions in early science were done by men that were very inspired, including Descartes. I mean, Descartes' greatest rational analysis actually came to him in a dream.
From an angel, that's right. An angel of
wisdom.
Yeah. And they leave that out of the philosophy books, too.
They do really tend to play it down, just like they really tend to deliberately censor astrology out of the history of astronomy. And I think it's really important to consider these people like the Magi, because they did have this wonderfully wedded cosmology that was, you know, science, as good as science got in their day, but it was always completely shot through with their religion and their spirituality and their metaphysics. There just was no split. It was all one for them.
Well, let me ask you a question that I actually have asked other astrologers who are involved in understanding the new discoveries, because right now, you know, with the Hubble telescope, they're always finding new objects in the sky. But even back in the ancient days, how did they equate a planet or light in the sky with a certain set of characteristics that would affect human behavior? How did they come up with those correlations?
Well, from what we can determine, there were two ways. And, you know, we do have, particularly in Mesopotamia, from the Assyrians, from the Babylonians, we have a lot of records because they tended to write on clay tablets, and those, a lot of them are very well preserved. So we have a lot of records. In fact, we've only just begun to translate all of them. So there's a lot more still to be translated. Now, there's two basic ways that they derived these. First was from observation. And they did a tremendous amount of systematic observation, and they recorded their observations, recorded the consequences, the circumstances that would come after certain astronomical alignments, and they would consult those. So there was definitely an observation and correlation process. That's the first way.
Okay, that makes sense.
The second way, and there was quite a lot of this as well, is they would derive sort of symbolic systems that they thought should work, and they would rely on those as well. And
like what? What would that be, symbolic system?
Well, let's put it this way. I like to refer to it as the Greek way, the idea, for instance, of the Ptolemaic universe that the circle is the perfect figure. Therefore, the heavens must be spheres, and everything must move in perfect circles. People derived this kind of idea symbolically and metaphysically. It wasn't necessarily based upon observations, although, you know, sometimes the observations tended to confirm it, and a lot of times they didn't. But they held on to that idea for a very long time, and so you had this big showdown with Copernicus and then Galileo with the church. So that's exactly what I mean. They would come up with these symbolic systems, ways of saying, well, the universe should work like this, and we're going to act like it works like this, whether it does or not, because we're sure it works this way a priori. So there was quite a bit of that as well. You know, they would determine numerically or geometrically that things should be a certain way and then just proceed as if they were. So you had the two lines of operation, even in the most ancient astronomy and astrology. You actually had observation and correlation, but you also had this, you know, very stubborn human superstitious side that still kind of refuses to go away, even in our postmodern circumstances.
Well, obviously, though, on some level, the universe did work the way the Magi predicted it would, because they were successful. They were, you know, held in respect by, for hundreds of years, by the royalty of the ancient Near East. So there was something in their cosmology that was obviously working. I mean, their astrology worked.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a lot of their methods, you know, still work to this day if you actually know how to use them with a modicum of common sense and experience. Yes, absolutely. And the, you know, the observation and correlation approach, I think, is pretty sound. That's the basis of modern science.
Right.
The superstitious symbolic side has its uses if you don't get too attached to it. You know, it also has its uses as well. So, yeah, I think there were really fascinating things. For instance, going back to this idea of the cycle of Jupiter and Saturn conjunctions, if you actually look at Persian history and the rise and fall of empires and dynasties and prophets and, you know, the kind of things that the Magi were interested in, it actually correlates amazingly well with the Jupiter-Saturn cycle, just as they said it did.
How do you explain, I mean, astrology definitely seems to work for me. How do you explain the effects? I mean, I know there's a correlation that they can observe, but how do you explain how those planets, in your understanding, actually do affect human behavior and thinking and thought and evolution and consciousness?
Well, Alan, if I could fully explain that, I'd probably have a Nobel Prize by now, but I'm working on it. Sometimes I feel like I can describe it, if not explain it. We don't completely understand, but I'll give you a kind of an analogy here.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is evolution and environment. Okay? You know, when you read the critics of astrology, they always like to say, yeah, you can't prove that any celestial body has any influence on human life on Earth. That's absurd. You know, it's not gravitational, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, it's really obvious that the sun and moon have a tremendous amount of influence on biological life at every level, from a single cell animal to a complex human being. In fact, the larger parts of the brain of just about any being and of humans as well, larger parts of the brain are actually devoted to optical processing. In other words, to perceiving light.
Mm-hmm.
And for the majority of our evolution, you know, what was the source of that light that they were processing? It was the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And at night, it was the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say that they don't have any influence on us. They in fact have a tremendous amount of influence on our biological being. Now, if you think about consciousness as kind of a biological correlate or concomitant, something that evolves along with the biological life forms, if the biological life forms are obviously responding to the sun and the moon and who knows what else, perhaps the consciousness is also evolving in relationship to those aspects of its environment as well. And that's what I think we see in what I call the astrological model of consciousness.
I tend to agree with that. I think that, you know, of course the sun and moon are obvious in there because they're, you know, they're daily occurrences. Other things like stars and constellations that are, you know, hundreds of thousands of light years away, you know, according to astrologers, still do have an effect. And I think in my hypothesis, it has to do with the interconnectedness of all things in the universe. We are, you know, in Bohm's understanding of the universe, all things are connected. You know, you spin an atom one way over here, its pair spins the other way. I mean, there's correlations throughout the universe, and I think astrology is probably just another obvious correlation between everything that seems to be connected.
Of course that's true, and that is an underlying assumption astrological practice.
But there's some sort of quantum physics law that we haven't maybe discovered yet, but might explain it at some point if we evolve to enough of an open understanding of what's possible, you know, in the world. I think we might come into an explanation
I agree, and it may not even be, the answer may not even be in quantum physics. It may be in biology. It may be in consciousness studies.
Yeah.
But it does come back to that basic principle that it's all one. It all comes from the same place. It's all interconnected at some really profound level. And indeed, you know, what I've learned from observing the universe all these years is that it's all shot through with meaning. It's all shot through with relevance as part of that interconnectedness, and I find that very exciting.
Right. I mean, just to quote Bohm, David Bohm, the physicist, he says that, you know, basically everything is part of a hologram that is then reflected inside of us. You know, on a deeper level of reality, particles or individual entities are really extensions of some fundamental basic structure. We're all connected on some very subtle levels of reality.
It is a fractal universe. There are these repeating patterns that enlarge, and that's why metaphor works, because whatever's happening on that smaller level is reflective in a fractal kind of relationship of what's happening on the larger level, and vice versa. And astrology is, I think, a real key to that, and it's something that we as human beings picked up on thousands and thousands of years ago, and it's sort of evolved along with us through all of our changes and our ups and downs.
And it's still evolving as new asteroids and new stars are being found. Astrologers are really busy these days keeping up with how do they fit into people's charts and how do they fit into our evolution.
It's a great time. It's a great time to be an astrologer. I think the best astrologers that ever lived are actually alive today, and they're doing amazing things with it. And, you know, by the way, in the last 100 years, we've learned so much about the universe. You know, the great advances in cosmology have all occurred, say, within the last 100 years, and we're just coming to grips with all of that and with what all of that means, and I foresee a much larger role for astrology in the coming years in the field of cosmology. And
what
really,
do you mean in that sense? How do you see it happening? What's coming? Just hypothesize. It doesn't matter.
Well, first off, you know, what physicists are learning is yes, there it is a universe of meaning, and whatever we perceive about it is so tied to the nature of our consciousness in the first place that it's really hard to separate it out. And the only field that constructively engages with those kind of issues is astrology. You know, the idea of extracting meaning from the cosmos and making it applicable to human life and human existence. So I think we're really on the verge of a much wider application of astrological principles and a much wider understanding of it. We've got so much more technology now to apply to it. We can do much better levels of research, and that's all happening now. It's all being done. We're also much more aware of, you know, all these different bodies, as you were saying earlier, and what their potential influences are. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be practicing.
It is a lot of subtle, and the subtle bodies is more experiences, the expansion of consciousness. But let me just talk to you about the Magi a little, because you've really researched and studied this subject, although I was surprised you didn't make any reference to Rudolf Steiner, who's written a lot. Are you aware of his work about the Magi?
Well, I am aware of Steiner's work. I wouldn't exactly consider him a good academic source, let's put it that way.
He did say, though, and I'll quote, because I just read in a book today called Festivals and Their Meanings. He was talking about the Magi around Christmas, and stuff just came to Steiner. So he said the Magi possessed super earthly knowledge, which was actually a glorious remembrance of life before birth. This knowledge has shriveled away into a mathematic, mechanistic concept of the heavens. So it was Steiner saying that the Magi really understood something very deep about the nature of consciousness and our relationship to life. Yeah, I mean, I don't know where he got that from,
And see, that's my problem with Steiner. I don't know where he got any of this stuff from. And I'm not saying it's not true.
Right.
You know, I do like to lecture on university campuses from time to time, in which case you better bring some sources. And I think sources are great. You know, I'm much happier if I can pull up a historical text that was actually written by someone associated with the Magi saying that they believed in those things. That, to me, is verification. It's a lot more reliable.
Right, and you even go into the, some of the historical sources of the Gospels, you know, because they are obviously mm-hmm. written years after their occurrences.
And you know, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with doing it the other way. I mean, my preference, I have a lot of planets in Virgo, and I like the evidence. And I do find that when you stick to the evidence, mm-hmm. you know, when you stick to what people actually did rather than letting your imagination run wild with what you like to think they should have been, mm-hmm. you get a much better story.
Right.
You know, not only is it a real story, but it's actually a better story if you let the facts mm-hmm. speak for themselves.
So let's say, I mean, there were magi. Let's say there was someone named Jesus who was born, who obviously, whether he was the avatar of a new time, he actually then historically or, you know, sociologically became that in this age, you know. So if the magi then predicted this birth, they were the three wise men that came and brought these gifts of frankincense, myrrh, and gold. Actually, Steiner goes into a whole thing of what that means, but what was their purpose then in coming to this birth and giving these gifts, and what were they wanting from it? What was their point?
Well, you know, our only source for this story is the Gospel of Matthew.
Right.
And most scholars believe that it was a later addition to the Gospel of Matthew. It might have been added as late as 70 or 80 AD. So we want to be careful in attributing too much of a history to it. I think it's almost more interesting to see it as a story that's written, you know, some time after the events that it claims to be describing. What this would have meant for Matthew, or whoever put it in Matthew, and for the early Christians was quite a lot. It's telling us some really important things. First off, that there was a great affinity between how they viewed their Christianity and how they viewed the religion of the Persian Magi. They're kind of putting themselves in the same boat.
Or were they even Christians at that point? Weren't they sort of a kind of sect of Judaism at that point where Matthew was written? It wasn't even
Christianity. Well, yes, they were. However,
you make a good point between the Persians and the Jews, you know, at that point having a very close relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. They had a sense that they were practicing the same religion, maybe different branches of the same religion, but operating in that same larger religious tradition. And I think that's very, very important because we've gotten so separate and we see ourselves as having such separate origins that the very presence of the Persian Magi opening up the Christian Gospels is a slap in the face, is a potent reminder that these people didn't see themselves as separate. They saw themselves as operating in the same tradition and working with the same and similar expectations.
I think
we could all do really well to get back to that more inclusive state of mind.
Wait, which people do you mean? The Jews at the time working with the Persians and the Zoroastrians? Or who was really in alignment at that point?
The Jews, the Persians, and the early Christians. Because it really speaks to all of them.
Uh-huh.
It speaks to the Persian expectations of a Messiah, the Jewish expectations, and, of course, the way the early Christian church saw itself.
And was it a slap in the face to the Romans then as well? Because the Romans and Persians probably didn't get along, did they?
Yeah, it was definitely directed against the Romans and their puppet King Herod. But I think it's also a slap in the face for your contemporary fundamentalists who like to think of themselves as very separate and very exclusive and having this unique origin. And I think that if they go back to their own scriptures, it's telling them a bigger story, a much more inclusive story that I think is more important now than ever.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So the bigger story is that there's all these influences from Persians, Zoroastrianism, which is what the Magi were, and something that really is way beyond a sort of limited Judaic value of a god back then. There's a huge story that hasn't been included in the fundamentalist understanding of what Christianity was.
Absolutely. They've really distorted their own histories to try to demonstrate exclusivity and that they have this separate origin and in Revelation and that their religion is better than anyone else's. And it's not just the Christians. I mean, the Judeans do it, the Christians do it, the Muslims do it.
Well, everybody does
except the Persians do it, yeah. But in fact, and at this point where I think we're in kind of a crisis of religious values, it's really important to point up the historical facts that these were all just branches of the same tree. You know, they're all coming out of the same tradition, and there's tremendous underlying unity. There's a tremendous amount of common ground there, and we really need that common ground right now, I think.
And the Zoroastrianism, Zoroastra was a monotheistic religion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
And it was the source for so many of the traditions that have persisted throughout all of the great monotheisms, not just the monotheism itself, but the dualism, the idea that there's a god and a devil, you know, there's a good god, a principle.
That's from the Persian understanding that was then incorporated.
Absolutely. The Persians were very dualistic. And see, they perceived all of time and history and the universe as a staging ground for the battle between the good god and the force of evil. Absolutely. Yeah, and this is not Judaism. These are not Judean ideas. This comes from the Persian religion. And the idea that this battle between good and evil is all leading up to a great battle at the end of time, at the end of the world, where the forces of good will battle the forces of evil and vanquish them forever. And usher in this whole new millennium of peace. This is a huge part of Christianity and of Islam.
Uh-huh.
But these aren't Christian, Jewish, or Islamic ideas. They all come from the Persian religion, the Zoroastrian religion.
That is a beautiful point. I think that's a very important point. Now, there was something, though, whether it happened or not, there's something specific in these gifts that these magis offer, though, that are a clue to something else. Myrrh and frankincense are very powerful cleansing herbs, and if you burn them, they're supposed to clear the energy field. And gold is a very pure, it's the purest element that on the planet, I mean, as far as its energetic configuration. So there's something symbolically and being suggested in these gifts.
Yes, I'm sure that there is, and I wish we could, you know, dig the author of Matthew up from the grave and ask him, you know, what exactly did you mean? But we can't really do that, so we're left to some extent with speculation. But they were very nice gifts. They were very expensive gifts. You know, gold was for kings. It's the highest metal, the purest metal, and the most beautiful. And myrrh and frankincense, these are tools of priests, and the magi were certainly priests. So there's been many interpretations put upon these gifts.
Well, my interpretation, and I'll just go for it, is the sense that they were giving to this person an early initiation, which through the life of Jesus, you can see he went through various initiations to gain greater and greater wisdom. So in a sense, this was a fulfillment of a tradition, a secret tradition perhaps, a mystery school, where from birth you were known to be an initiate of great knowledge, and it wasn't just Jesus, many, many people, but you know, this was the most popular story we've come down to here, but there were many that
that's perhaps true, you know, and an interesting part of that within the Magi priesthood, and they were an official priesthood, it was hereditary. You had to be born to it, and the same would be true of the Jewish priesthood. It was a hereditary caste, so unless you were born to it, you weren't exactly going to, you know, go to a university and get a degree in theology and get ordained. That's not how it worked.
But then isn't that interesting? If it was that, then what would the Magi be doing showing up at this birth then? I mean, if it was that, I mean, what you
guess? Well, you know, we really can't be sure, because, you know, in the same book, Matthew goes to great lengths to demonstrate that Jesus is born of the tribe of Judah, to show that he's a king.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's a fit king to overthrow Herod. Now, if he's born of the tribe of Judah, of the priestly tribe, I mean, excuse me, the kingly tribe, then he's not a Levite. He's not a priest. Unless Mary was. And there's some tradition that Mary was of the tribe of Levi and her father was a priest. So, you know, there's all kinds of traditions that are bound up in this. We want to be careful not to take it as history, because even by the time the information gets in the Gospel of Matthew to us, it's been stepped on several times by people with various agendas. And it gets kind of hard to unravel that at the end of the day.
The other really, really exciting thing in your book, The Star of the Magi, that I haven't really seen other places is this understanding of when Israel and Judea split after the death of King Solomon, and that it was this, and then, of course, Israel was destroyed, the 10 tribes were lost. You say they weren't really lost, and they actually existed, and they, you know...
They still exist to this day.
Where are they? Who are they?
They're the Samaritans.
And who
and
are
they
the
live in the traditional area of Samaria. It's actually outside of the town of Nablus in modern-day Israel. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. They're two very different people. They were two very different countries, and... The 10 tribes didn't exactly disappear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Israel was wiped off the face of the earth by the Assyrians in 722 BC. But
right.
there were quite a lot of native Israelis who stayed in the territories,
mm-hmm.
even though Assyria took it over and brought in colonists, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a contingent of diehard Israelis that stayed there and that maintained their traditions. They absolutely did not accept the Judean temple cult as Jerusalem. They saw that as a later Persian invention.
The cult of the temple was a Persian invention?
The Persians built the second temple. The Persians
restored the first temple existed while the country was unified, though, so it wasn't.
We don't know that for sure. That's what the Bible's telling us, but the Bible is a much later Judean document, and it has its own reasons for telling us that. The archaeological evidence doesn't really suggest that that's true at all.
Well, if you go to the Temple Mount, though, in Jerusalem, the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, there are stones there that are huge that date back to the first temple. You know,
no, they don't. That's actually from Herod's temple, from the time of Christ.
Even the bigger stones that are...
Yes, absolutely. When Herod built that temple just before
uh-huh.
Christ was born,
uh-huh.
he probably did so much damage to the earlier foundations that we may never know, but those stones in the Wailing Wall are only from Herod's temple. Now, we can't do any further excavations right now because of the Muslim restrictions from the Dome of the Rock, but it may not matter anyways. The general consensus is that Herod probably dug most of that stuff up, so we really have no archaeological evidence of the first temple. What we do know
uh-huh.
is this idea that in the time of David and Solomon, that Jerusalem was this great city with a big temple and a huge empire, that was not true at all. At the time of David and Solomon, Jerusalem was very, very small. And if it had any kind of temple at all, it would have been quite small and pretty primitive. It was actually Israel in the area around Nablus that was a huge empire and had massive buildings and a big temple. It wasn't Jerusalem. So you have to be really careful with that material. It's not historical. It is much later material, and it's written with a very deliberate political agenda to exalt the Jerusalem cult and the Jerusalem throne over Israel. And that's a very complex issue.
No, I think that's very intelligent. Although, you know, and I appreciate that, although it does seem you do rely on some faith, the fact that Jesus claims to be whoever he is, you know, whoever they claim to be. And I don't know if there's historical evidence for that, you know, of who Jesus was or what his mission was. Do you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, people, I don't know what your, you know, religious beliefs is, but, are, but how do you understand who Jesus was along those same academic terms, you know?
Well, that's a fair enough question, you know,
yeah.
And first I'll say this, I mean, whatever I believe or feel or think about Jesus personally, is not going to change the fact that if we had to say who's the single most important person in all of Western history, kind of comes down to one person.
No, I totally agree. I totally
You know, I'd want to separate that. I mean, I'm a Christian. I was born and raised a Christian. I'll always be a Christian, but I'm probably the most, you know, broadest practicing Christian astrologer that you'd ever want to come across. So I don't fit in any fundamentalist or orthodox box by any means.
But,
and certainly if you've read my book, I think
But you're so academic and so really exact in the understanding of, you know, the Old Testament and all that, and I really appreciate the scholarship, then in the New Testament, in the time of Jesus, how do we know, though, what is accurate and who Jesus really was and all that, if we take that same analysis, you know? I mean, what's your
thought? Well, I think that there's a tremendous amount of work being done along those lines to get to, you know, the root of what was actually going on in those days, and certainly... There's even in the earliest texts of the New Testament, say in, you know, Paul's epistles, there's a tremendous amount of dogma and belief that's bound up in any account that they're trying to give us of what actually happened. You know, when you get into the question of, you know, spiritually, what was the Christ and what was the role that Jesus played spiritually, I don't think that's an academic question, Alan.
No, I totally agree, and I totally accept people's faith and intuitive spiritual feelings about their ideology. That's something that's so deep in people that there's an essence that they just need to go with your feelings, and that's
if you asked any practicing Christian that has any kind of a personal relationship with God through Christ or however they want to describe it, you're going to get a different answer from each one of them. And you should.
Right.
Because, you know, each individual has a different experience and a different path. And this idea that religion should be one size fits all, I don't buy into at all.
Well,
but
It's an individual thing, in a sense, right? Religion, wouldn't you say?
It's William James that said it's temperament, temperament, temperament. And speaking as an astrologer, I couldn't agree more. You know, people are so individualistic and they have such different needs. They have different spiritual needs. They have different religious needs. They're at different points in the journey. So
right.
They're going to experience it differently and they're going to fulfill those needs differently, and that's fine. That's why we have such a, you know, a plethora of belief systems to choose from.
So the
you
word
know, they're all good at certain
definitely.
Points.
Definitely, the word Christ is a Greek word. Now, how do you understand that?
Yeah, see, the word Christ is a Greek word. You know, we spend so much time trying to prove that Christianity had strictly Judean origins and it has no taint of paganism to it at all. Then why is the word Christ a Greek word?
Yeah. Yeah.
You see, something about the impact of Christ upon the larger Greek world in the time of Paul, it just seemed to fulfill so many people's contemporary aspirations that people could come to Christianity from almost any belief system available in those days, and it met some need in them. It impacted them. It changed them. It was very vital, and it's still doing that to people today.
So what does Christ mean in its Greek sense of the word, then?
Christos. It's like the anointed one in Judaism. Boy, that's a good one. We'd have to go back to the actual, you know, dictionary and look that one up, but even that wouldn't completely convey it. It's that idea of God made man, of one who's thoroughly enlightened, thoroughly God-realized, but also who impacts history at that critical moment and pushes humanity along to the next big step forward.
Because many
That's
people,
my definition.
I like that, and I think it's many people's understanding is that it's time now for the Christ to come forward in each person. Each one of us is a potential Christos, Christ-like being. That's where we're coming into this age, this Aquarian age. That's my understanding. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, and I think that would be great, you know, and the earliest Christians were trying to teach that, each in their own way, and I think even if you went into a fundamentalist church today, once you got through all the fundamentalism at the bottom of it, you'd find the same impetus, you know, that they're trying to reach that Christ within every human heart and shine it up and bring it forward and give it a place to be and to express itself more fully, because we need that more than ever as well.
I mean, I think this is what the Gnostics were doing and the Essenes. I mean, do you think Jesus was an Essene?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think there's very little doubt that both he and John the Baptist came out of these splinter cults. I don't even like to use the word Essene because it's a little too narrow, but there were all kinds of really radical Judean splinter cults out in the deserts, and definitely both John the Baptist and Jesus came out of them. And yeah, they were trying to bring individuals to that individual knowing, that individual enlightenment, if you will. Yeah.
I see, and that's where we... And just getting back to the Sumerians, you said the Sumerians still around today?
Oh, yeah, they still are in their traditional territories around... The town today is called Nablus, but it's on the site of the old Samaritan capital, and it's near these two mountains that were very holy to the ancient Israelis. They had stories about Joshua leading the people around the mountains, and that's where the Samaritans still practice to this day. They still keep their Passover there, and they've done DNA testing on
uh-huh.
these people to try to determine who they were, and the DNA test results have actually concluded that they are the descendants of the ancient priests of Israel.
Wait, but there must be a vastly reduced population compared to the 10 tribes that populated
yeah.
the northern...
Well, it's a very small population nowadays, and they suffered tremendous persecution over the years, a lot of it from the Judeans. Who claim to be Israel themselves.
Do they consider themselves Jews or not?
No. Jews are Judeans. It's very different. And the Judeans really hated the Samaritans, and they were very intolerant of them. They were their dread enemies.
Huh, that's interesting. So the Samaritans that exist today, they'll practice Passover, you're saying?
Oh, yes. And they have their own... Torah, the first five books of the Bible, they consider their version to be, you know, earlier and more accurate than the Judean one, and the scholars can all sort that out. You know, the jury's still out on that one.
I mean, how many would you say exist of the Sumerians today?
Well, don't quote me on this,
right.
But it's several thousand that are actually there in Nablus and part of the community. And that only marry within the community, but it is very small. Their numbers are very reduced. It's in fact it's a miracle that they've managed to hang on all this time. But these are not the only remnants of the lost tribes. Now, when the Assyrians conquered Israel in 722, they took a lot of the Israeli people into captivity and deported them. Into, I guess we would now call it northern Iraq, not too far from the original territory of the Magi, south of the Caspian Sea. And there was a pretty active Jewish community there, and in fact, let me get this straight, around the first century B.C., they declared this area Adiabene, and their king converted to Judaism because of this history of Israeli colonization, and they actually had sort of a little Israeli kingdom going there for a couple of generations, and they considered themselves the real heirs of Israel, of the people of Israel, again, kind of in opposition to the Judean temple. But there are even times when they sent tithes to the Judean temple. We have some records of that as well. So the lost tribes were there in Iraq, and the lost tribes were definitely there in Samaria. They weren't all that lost.
Right, and some people say they even became the Irish, the tribe of Dan. You've heard that rumor, right?
Yeah, they've said that. It's a little hard to demonstrate it conclusively, but...
But speaking of the conversion, most of the world's Jews are Ashkenazi, and they are converted tribes living in Eastern Europe. They're not part of the Semitic Judean diaspora. They're later converts. Do you know about that?
Well, not too much, but you're right. They are European Jews, and if you look at them, they don't look Jewish at all. I mean,
and
not in the traditional
90%
sense.
90% of the world's Jews, and they... You know, and I think there's a whole thing where it's a political sort of conditioning that keeps that knowledge secret or separate or hidden, the fact that they're not related to any Zionistic homeland in Israel, you know?
Yeah, and this is a really difficult situation, and I think it's been a very hurtful situation for the whole cause of world peace, you know, that... We really need to get our history straight about, you know, what's really being represented by the state of Israel these days.
Well,
I think the Islamic people obviously have a very different idea of the history of that area, and they seem to, you know, resent the presence there. And I can sympathize to some extent with how they feel.
You know, in the last little bit, I know you've written a whole book about this. I'd like to just ask you a little bit. You wrote a book called The Visions of the Virgin Mary, An Astrological Analysis of Divine Intercession. Was this a historical overview of all the places that Mary has appeared on the planet? Is that what this book is about?
Somewhat. I really focused in this book on modern Marian apparitions. Because there's so many great contemporary apparitions that have occurred in the last 150 years or so. And I wanted to look at them very much in a comparative religion context, because this is not by any means an exclusively Christian or Western phenomenon. These kinds of apparitions occur all over the world.
I track them, and I know in India, I mean, the whole divine feminine does appear to people, yes.
Oh, yeah, and in Japan and China, they have their whole traditions. A real hotbed for Marian apparitions right now is Egypt.
Right, there was even videos of Mary walking around the steeple of a church, supposedly,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. So it's not an exclusively Christian phenomena by any means. So I decided to look at the major modern apparitions, the ones that have actually undergone a very thorough investigation, not, you know, Mary appearing in a piece of pizza or on a wheat silo.
But Fatima and Lourdes and those places. And what did you discover about that astrologically?
Well, here's the thing, looking on it in that comparative religion context, what I also realized very quickly was that there were very distinct astrological patterns that were present that kind of made the same statement. You know, in astrology we have certain signs that are more representative of the female mother goddess kind of energy, or particularly Virgo, you know, the female virgin goddess kind of energy. We also have certain planets like the moon or Venus that are representative of that. And so what I found in, you know, telling the stories of these apparitions and doing the charts of the visionaries and of the, you know, exact time of the initial apparitions was that these astrological figures were very startlingly present and were repeated and were telling that same, you know, larger story. That, again, it's not an exclusively Christian or Catholic phenomenon. It's a very universal kind of phenomenon. And also that I think there's something very, very real going on there.
Oh, I definitely think there's something real going on. Do you know about the apparition that happened in the Bronx in 1945 to Joe Vitello? Did you know about that?
No. Which one was that?
That was a very real apparition. It was 1945, a young Italian kid, 9 years old, saw this vision of the Virgin Mary, and Mary appeared there 12 days in a row. And on the 12th day, this is up on the Grand Concourse, it was packed full of thousands of people, and people were having healings. It was even sanctioned by the church. It was quite a phenomena. So
it was actually approved by the church?
It was. There were church officials there. In 1945, there's an article, if you search the Times, it says, "The Boy Who Saw the Virgin." And I went up there to visit him and did a little interview with him about his apparitions, and there's a painting of the Mary that he saw. It's right in line with all those other sightings of this being, whoever this is. But yeah.
Well, one thing you learn if you get into the field of Marian apparitions is that it's very common. It's very, very common. It actually happens a lot.
Huh.
And it's part and parcel of our greater religious tradition that we've inherited from the ancient world. And again, some of the most, you know, beautiful apparition stories are not even Christian. They're
right.
They're from India or they're from Egypt.
Or
but,
the Virgin
but telling
of,
us,
the Virgin
pardon
of
me?
Guadalupe, I was going to say, is another one.
Yeah, that's a wonderful crossover kind of an apparition showing the merging of the Aztec belief system and the goddesses of the Aztec belief system as they tried to find some accommodation in the new Catholic world order that was being imposed upon them.
Right.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story.
So what is the configuration, just to kind of summarize, I know you wrote a whole book about it, but what is the configuration you found that seems to be common throughout all these apparitions?
Well, there's to boil it down, probably two things. First is the sign Virgo,
uh-huh.
for the obvious reasons. You know, Virgo is that harvest goddess, that harvest pure harvest goddess of purity, and you know, even from the earliest days of the Christian Church, the sign Virgo was very closely associated with the Virgin Mary, and you do find again astonishing configurations in Virgo, both with the visionaries and with the apparition charts. The other big one is the moon, which is sort of the astrological heavenly mother, the great white goddess, the moon. And, of course, the moon sign, the moon rules Cancer. So, again, you'd often see a really powerful emphasis on the moon or the sign Cancer in the charts. So I investigated it very thoroughly, but the book itself, it was a very easy, relatively easy book to write because I just took it one apparition at a time and really tried to tell the story because these apparition stories are wonderful. you can just imagine, as you said, with the fellow who saw the apparition in New York in 1945, thousands of people come out and this whole circus and sideshow breaks out and there's all these great characters and you just
yeah.
see the great display of human nature and how they respond to these apparitions. So I just wrote the book as a series of stories about what happened when these people started to report that they were seeing this. And then I was able to weave in the history and the comparative religion and even the astrology, I think, in a rather seamless and whole kind of way, all in the context of telling these great stories that have so much life in them to begin with. So even if somebody, you know, doesn't know anything about astrology when they start reading the book, I've laid it out so that they don't need to. And they can learn it all in context. And by the time they get to the end of it, not only will they know a lot more about these apparitions, but they'll have picked up a lot of the astrology along the way as well.
Well, I'm going to send you an article about this guy who, and I'm seeing it now, October 29th, 1945.
When was it? October 29th, 1945?
Yes. So
yes, I'd really like to see that.
Yeah,
I'm already trying to calculate the planetary positions, as you told me.
He was 9 years old, and he saw the Virgin Mary, and for 12 days appeared there. And I was up on the Grand Concourse. We went up to visit him. I think he might still be there somewhere. Joe Vitello, he says, all the other visionaries made a fortune. Look at me. I'm sitting in this little place. So, you know, he's never had another experience in his life that matched that, you know. And but there's a shrine to Mary up there on the Grand Concourse, which is behind his house, and people can go and meet him.
Well, there was a massive series of apparitions with Veronica Lukin out on Long Island there.
Oh, really?
Until quite recently. I think she's passed away recently. But
Uh-huh.
Oh, they used to get thousands and thousands of people out there.
No, that's very interesting work. But so just to wrap up here, is there, I mean, we're in a new year now. Do you see anything astrologically coming up in this year that people should know about or interesting?
Yes, there's a presidential election.
Okay. Anything astrological that you can tell us about the election?
Yeah. Well, I think it's all astrological, and I think this election is very, very important, and the opportunity that it gives us. As a country in crisis with a lot of big issues facing us, we've got this wonderful opportunity with Jupiter in Capricorn, Saturn in Virgo, where it can really hash a lot of things out in the course of this election. I really hope that everybody's going to take the opportunity to kind of grapple with these problems and try to figure out some real-world solutions. And the campaign is giving us a perfect opportunity to do this. So I think it's going to be a great year. And we are really
Hillary
going to have a chance. Pardon me?
Hillary Clinton, do you see a Hillary Clinton winning the election, or what's your prediction?
Well, I think it's hers to lose. You know, it would be really great if she and Obama could team up already and not be taking shots at each other. Because I see two things developing in this election, and I've put a lot of analysis into this. As I said, we've got this great opportunity to really examine all these policies and examine all these problems and propose all these potential solutions. That's constructive. That's really helpful. Okay, and if we go that route, that'll be great. The downside is if the Republicans really want to win, if they can create enough of a military crisis and really put, you know, a lot of fear in people's minds that we have this great enemy out there that we've got to fight, it's going to put all of our resources in that direction, and they'll win. So that's what we need to be really careful of. You know, the enemy is within. The enemy is us, and we really need to sort these problems out and not get distracted.
Do you see any configurations that we should be aware of, any planetary configurations that are interesting as you look to this year?
Well, as I said, we've got this great lineup of Jupiter in Capricorn and Saturn in Virgo, and that's going to be going on for the better part of the year. And it's so potentially so constructive. It's so down-to-earth and real-world and very analytical. You know, we've got problems. We need to break them down and solve them and start proposing really practical, you know, real-world kind of solutions. How are we going to redo our energy economy? You know, what kind of renewable, sustainable alternatives are we really going to start implementing, okay? We really need to do this, and we've got the opportunity. The other configuration is Mars and Neptune. If we get all paranoid and feeling threatened about, you know, some enemy out there, that's going to lead to our destruction. But I think there's a real chance that America might go that way. You know, so I'm trying to talk about this a lot and help people to understand the forces at work here. You know, that the enemy is within us. We need to take care of what we're doing and not get distracted into more foreign wars, because there's a very real potential that we could. And
right.
I'd hate to see that happen. It would be the worst thing for everybody.
It would, including the planet and everyone on it. So I'm totally with you. So it looks like it is a good time astrologically to build a more solid and more real and practical foundation in solving some of the problems that we've created in the last few years.
Yeah, and let go of a lot of this paranoia and persecution complex we've developed that we're under attack. We're not under attack, okay? We have nothing to be worried about.
Attackers.
There's a lot of other people. Yeah. Pardon me?
I said we're the attackers. We're not under
attack. Absolutely. we've kind of lost perspective here, okay?
I know.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of cleaning up of our own mess to do, and that's the real message with Saturn and Virgo. Clean up your mess, everybody. Don't worry about what other people are doing. So hopefully that message will hit home and take root.
Mm-hmm. thank you, Courtney. Thank you for all this interesting information. Very good, important information. I've been talking to Courtney Roberts, the author of The Star of the Magi, a very interesting academic scholarly book on the Magi's tradition and influences on the Judeo-Christian paradigm that we've been living out, I would say. And also her book, The Visions of the Virgin Mary, an Astrological Analysis of Divine Intercession. And also your website then is, what is it, Courtney?
Okay, I've got two websites. The first one is www.CourtneyRobertsHolm.com. CourtneyRobertsHolm.com. And the other is thestarofthemagi.com. And Magi is M-A-G-I. So CourtneyRobertsHolm.com and thestarofthemagi.com.
Right, and you might be in the city doing book signings or even interviews, and maybe I'll bring you on my television show. We could do a roundtable discussion with some other scholars. Because I've interviewed the guy who wrote the book, Rabbi Jesus, Bruce Chilton. Do you know his work?
Bruce Chilton, yes. He's at Bard. He's wonderful.
Yes, yes. I've interviewed him. It'd be interesting to have you two talk about...
it would, and he's brilliant, yeah. That'd be a great combination, because we're both coming from such different points of view, but he's wonderful.
Right. You can actually see my interview with Bruce Chilton on YouTube if you go to YouTube.
I'll look for it.
Okay.
I'll look for it. So, yeah, well, it's always great talking with you, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you. I'll just end with this song called The Song of the Soul, but I just want to tell people this is Alan Steinfeld. Every week on bbsradio.com, which is generally Tuesdays at 10 p.m. New York time or 7 p.m. California time. This program actually originates in California. I mean, this is where bbsradio.com is located, but they're really branching out to, you know, do this planetary internet system, internet radio, so I think it's great. I also do a cable show in Manhattan, which is on every Monday night at 9 p.m. Channel 57. You can look at that at, my website, which is newrealities.tv. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I have been talking to Courtney Roberts. Thank you, Courtney. And I'm going to play this song.
Oh.